Thomas is here. Michelle is here for Bill. Ken Jones. Kathy Sulik.
I'm here.
Elizabeth Sal is there.
Yeah.
Jeff Wozniak.
I'm here.
Chris. Sarah's here.
Yep.
Tatiana's here. Deepak. Johan.
Yep.
Tom or Kathy from NoFap.
Kathy's here.
Tom's here.
Kathy, I owe you a phone call.
Yeah, that's okay. No worries. We'll catch up.
I'll call you right after this is over or shortly after.
Okay.
Hey, John Hannigan.
Here.
Hannah here. Dan Savage. Susan Tapert, Dale, and Bill. Okay, well, reasonable. All right, so we have a few items on the agenda. First of all, hopefully a number of you will be able to be at the RSA meeting. And we have dinner scheduled. I believe Bill will fill us in on Monday night at 7 p.m. And I just wanted to get a quick count of people's requests and priorities. We have two choices, eat inside the hotel or outside the hotel. Outside the hotel, they'll come and pick us up in a van and take us to the restaurant. It's about a mile or so away. But if people have plans and would prefer just to stay in the hotel, we can eat in the hotel. So any obvious preferences? The only other thing that I know is going on, there's posters until about 7 o'clock, I believe, and then there's a reception, a few receptions that night that start around 9. So if you need to be at any of those things, you're better off staying in the hotel for dinner. Any ideas? Hello?
Yes?
In or out?
I'm easy.
Hello, Ed. It's Michael. How are you?
Good, Michael. How are you?
Very good, thank you.
All right, so no one has a preference?
Is it a red lobster?
Oh.
We are open to anything here.
All right, well, it's Johnny something or other bistro or whatever. Jill, real fast, what was it, about $50 a person?
Yeah, Johnny's Hideaway or Hemingway's or the Cascade inside the Hyatt.
Right, but Johnny's Hideaway, they had a meal for what, $50 or something?
Yeah, they're both about $50 without liquor.
Wow.
Or there was the third choice was a little less expensive in the hotel.
The $40 at the Cascade.
So there are the three choices we have. Two would be $50 plus whatever you drink, and the other one will be around $40. So there are no inexpensive places to eat. I need some ideas quick. And I'll just decide. Thank you.
You decide, and we'll be happy with it.
Well, all right.
That's my opinion.
You're the decider.
I decide. Okay. Well, I try to, you know, at least give people choices. All right. So hopefully that will definitely be Monday at 7 p.m. All right. I've asked Michael to kind of give us. Michael attended the past meeting in May that was held in Rockville or Bethesda. And, Michael, you just want to give an overview of your impressions of possibilities of what's going on there and what you feel was accomplished?
Sure. So I went to their CFAS-like meeting. And it was interesting. It's interesting to see, you know, it's like going to someone else's family and seeing what they fight about and what they're happy about. and what seems to be working and where they seem to be struggling. I think that the strength of CFAS everybody is familiar with is the really very large numbers of patients that they've ascertained. And I would say that the challenge that PASS has is that they don't know what they're looking at yet, because they have decided to not break codes for the most part as they go through their population. They have as a strength the fact that they set the whole thing up over a period of time before they started enrolling subjects, and that means that they have a fairly high degree of standardization in their various instruments and how they're going about looking at things. They had, as of the time that I was looking, they started enrollment in August of 2007. And they've done a total of almost 8,000 newborn assessments. They have, I think, in terms of clinical diagnosis on the ATNAT. Does everybody know what an ATNAT is? The Amiel Tyson Neurological Assessment, ATNA. Something like 2% severe, 46% moderate, 16% minor. I think that they are very amenable to collaboration in some areas. The request that some of you individually had made to be able to get a control group, for example, for 3D facial imaging analysis, was something that had been working its way through their committees, and something that some of you have heard back on, and that they certainly said at the time they were very eager to do. So I'm hopeful that that will come through. They have tissue, including a lot of placenta. They presented a study on actually smoking and nicotinic acetylcholine alpha-4 subunit expression in placenta. They got very excited about it. I thought that it was early data at best and hard to conclude too much from it. Mostly presented the techniques that they're using and, you know, how they're doing, for example, physiological assessments. They're looking at spectral analysis of auditory evoked responses, brainstem auditory evoked responses. They're doing some imaging, a lot of things. I wondered whether they're looking at the core things that we would have thought would be most important for the questions that we're trying to answer, understanding that their focus is different because the underlying central theme in their work is sudden infant death, or at least that's a main theme, and of course they have more involved in brainstem regulation, for example, than we do, because that's terribly important in regulation of respiratory function in neonates and in infants. Let's see. In terms of statistics, they had in one of their studies 43% drinking at the time of the last menstrual period, 53% in the first trimester, 21% in the second, 19% in the third, which I thought was very high. And the combination of alcohol plus smoking wasn't as great, although they had plenty of smokers. So, you know, I would say on balance, it's a largely complementary program to what we're doing. they have larger numbers in some realms, probably more genetic samples than we have. They have tissue that we don't, including brain in small numbers of cases, and placenta in much, much larger numbers of cases. They're dealing with some of the same struggles about how to coordinate their data analysis and how to bring everybody together, how to make data available to other people. And as I said, I think their major constraint is that although they are analyzing the studies that they do, they don't know what any of it means and won't for a couple more years, because that's when the code gets broken.
Is it just trying to pull out just a group of FAS kids and a group of controls to start analyzing data at all, or no?
I didn't have the sense that they were interested in taking out a group of FAS kids and analyzing them. I think that they were more ready in response to our request to offer up controls where they had the 3D facial imaging already done, to be able to, together with us, look in more depth at the utility of 3D imaging in their patient population and to help us with ours. I didn't ask specifically for FAS kids, and I could always send Hannah a note and say, you know, is this something that you'd be willing to do? But I really made the pitch that that was asked for, which was for the controls.
We've asked for alcohol exposure data several times, and I don't think it's possible to receive it at this time. I mean, I think that's slated for release in 2015.
Yeah.
When I was there, we discussed just the massive amounts of data that they're going to have, and that my suggestion was, well, why don't you take definite FAS cases and definite controls in a smaller number and at least start to look at the data that you have, so that when 2016 rolls around, you don't have to look and go on a fishing expedition with 8,000 kids. You know, and you could get some papers out as well. So I didn't know whether they were going to pursue that or not. Did you get the impression that they would be open to collaboration? I mean, you presented what was going on in CFAS.
Right. And I have to say that they were very impressed with what's going on in CFAS. One thing that's impressive about CFAS is that it has data in publications, and that the data have in many realms been paradigm shifting, and I think that's very important. You know, I could stand there with measurable pride over the work of the CFAS investigators that I was presenting and say, well, that's kind of neat. Look at what we know that we didn't know before because of this. And they're just not there. CFAS and PASS could not be more opposite. CFAS was thrown together from current R01s that were actively engaged and conducting experiments and publishing papers, and sort of corralled into a consortium with eventually agreed upon metrics and instruments. PASS spent its first 3 years trying to figure out how to be an integrated consortium, and is now collecting data, but doesn't know necessarily what they're looking at. It's completely the opposite.
I would concur. So it's impressive what they have, but we don't know what they have.
We don't know what it's going to amount to, I think, is what strikes me the most. And the problem with that approach, of course, the strength is the standardization. and the large numbers. And when you combine those two, the potential for being able to marshal large numbers of subjects who were assessed in the same way. The problem with that approach is that science is iterative, and that sometimes after you've looked at the first 100 cases or the first 100 studies of whatever, you have a different idea and you go about collecting the next 100 differently, just as CFAS has done in its three cycles. They don't have the opportunity to do any corrections or to change direction based on what they learn. They're going to learn what they have in one fell swoop. And if there are going to be further changes, I suspect it's going to be another decade cycle. And I think that, they made a choice. I understand why they made the choice, which is large N and standardized procedures with very well-delineated goals agreed to in advance in exchange for the nimbleness that CFAST has to be able to react to the data that it produces and then to go change things. If we had taken their approach, we would be doing linear measurements of 3D facial images, and all of the wonderful advances that Peter's approach brought to us, both to the animal studies and the human studies, wouldn't be part of CFAS. I think that's one of many examples of how learning where you are, even in big science, which CFAS is, allows you to adjust and make changes so that you're not stuck with ideas that were hatched 5 years before.
Well, I'm hoping that CFAS is going to produce the data that will allow PASS to confirm it, and that, you know, we'll be out there, and a lot of what they could do could be confirmatory of what hopefully we will have found and published. So, because come 2016, they have a lot of data to analyze, I'll tell you that.
They do.
It's amazing. All right, well, thank you, Michael. I appreciate it. And if anyone has ideas for how we could integrate with the PASS project, let me know. Phil and Dale are scheduled to go over there, I believe, in September.
That is the hope, but we first have to get to RSA.
Yes, okay. Might be easier to get to South Africa.
Yeah, maybe so.
But it's an interesting project, and I was impressed. But it's going to be all in the data, how it comes out.
Hey,
all right.
Michael, did you get to talk to them about anything going on with brain imaging?
I showed your brains,
uh-huh.
So to speak. And I think they were very interested in it, but there wasn't an opportunity to discuss about brain imaging collaborations.
Okay.
When I was there, I talked to the woman that you know there, Elizabeth.
Yeah, Ernesta.
I mean, they have a lot going on. I mean, you know, they're doing functional connectivity, structural, and DTI, and they're doing it in young children, infants.
Right.
So it's impressive what they're doing, the sheer number of people that they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, they do have the issue, though, that a lot of the kids that they are studying are also victims of child abuse and violence and things like that. So
HIV.
Yeah. So, there are confounds, and that's why I look at it as hopefully confirmatory in many respects. All right, well...
And I want to add something. As most of you know, both Bill and I are involved with the PASS network as well as CFAS, so I would concur with everything I've heard so far, Michael's comments, your comments. And it's true. I mean, they haven't changed much along the way for the reasons Michael outlined. And, you know, their transition into their most recent five-year phase was, you know, very indicative of that. It was more, we just need more time, more money to complete the recruitment, whereas, as Michael pointed out, and we all know that CFAS made some very important changes, I think, in transitions into this new phase, which is a great thing. The folks at, in the PASS network understand that they've developed a very valuable cohort with lots of information gathered, lots of specimens gathered, and they are you know, making plans to do follow-up. But I think that the potential for follow-up on this population is much larger than they themselves can really take full advantage of. So I do think you folks could have a lot to think about and could open up discussions and try to find that ground where you can collaborate or have an independent study with their cohorts. I think there must be plenty of room there, and they don't want to see these kids get lost to follow up. I think it would be in everyone's interest.
Yeah, I concur. And there's going to be lots of opportunities to collaborate both within PASS and other sites. You know, WHO is now going to start a study in southern Africa. It's going to be kind of a epidemiology study, but they'll identify a number of kids. Dennis Lamblin, who's from the Reunion Islands, wants to collaborate, and they have some very unique populations, but unfortunately they don't have an infrastructure where it would be easy to, unless someone wanted to go live there for a while, to study those kids. But, I mean, there are lots of new opportunities opening up and new populations being identified.
And one other thing I would add about the PASS network, and in particular follow-up of the PASS cohort, is that they are very much, you know, a machine right now, trying to get to that 12,000th pregnancy and assessing that one-year outcome, and are, as has been said many times, very reluctant to peer into the data or reveal alcohol exposures and things like that for fear that it could change recruitment or in some way, you know, alter the study, because it's really powered to find that SIDS alcohol relationship. But I think when they after this phase is complete and it's a purely follow-up phase, I think the culture of, you know, whatever remains of PASS isn't going to be the same. It's going to be hopefully more like a CFAST sort of endeavor. So I wouldn't expect it's going to be status quo, you know, as we get past the next few years and the current study comes to a completion.
Okay.
I guess
all right.
I don't know, can I just say one thing real quick? So one thing we've been doing, because, you know, we've had a relationship with them in terms of 3D facial imaging, so we continue to discuss opportunities where we could continue to follow the kids that we've already collected images on at 1 month and are about to complete the 12-month image. So we continue to look for ways where maybe it wouldn't be the focus of a grant, but perhaps this could be an add-on where we could continue to collect longitudinal 3D facial images, particularly in those children, so that we could continue to follow them and look at trajectories. And so we've continued to do that, and they've been, I mean, we do it mostly with Hind, but he's very helpful. And so we've continued that discussion for the same reason, because I think it's a cohort we feel like we've already invested in, and we want to continue to follow them if we can.
I'm really interested in when they get old enough, but I don't feel like I'm in the loop, so.
Elizabeth?
Yes?
Can you guys have that conversation about doing it? Because we, Kathy and Johan are going to have presentations, and I don't want to cut them off of those.
Okay, absolutely.
All right. Just a few more items of business. Hopefully everyone's gotten their funding notice. As you may have noticed, budgets have been reduced. That was an across-the-board reduction. Everybody suffered equally. and we're just going to have to grin and bear it for right now. And it was totally due to the sequestration. And begging, pleading probably will have no outcome on that.
How large was the cut, Ed?
About 7%.
Thank you.
But I think we'll be okay. You know, people obviously have carryover money. You hopefully have seen the Google Doc that went out with the notice of this call. And you know, hopefully people have some carryover money because not all the projects were meeting their goals. And hopefully that'll help ease some of that cut. The CFAS website's being updated, and Jen has some requests about content and whether she wants to take 2 or 3 minutes and show what the website's now looking like. That's up to her. Jen? I guess, yep. I can't hear you, though, Jen.
Is that better?
Yeah, well, speak loud.
Okay. So the website, as it is right now, again, this isn't live yet. These changes haven't been made live. But I have it on the home page. You can see, again, we have the picture of everyone, our mission statement. And then we have news items at the bottom that are going to be rotating. I have only a couple of news stories, so one of the things that I really need from everybody
Michael?
Send me information about things that you have that are newsworthy, so please send those things to me. The other piece that's two other pieces where I want people to particularly review or send me information. And we want to have different types of videos and slide sets available here, so I'm relying on everyone to send that information for our educational efforts. Projects. I didn't get a lot of two slides, other edits, so if you look at research projects, I can hear you.
You're breaking up, Jen.
Okay, hold on. Jill popped her head and said she couldn't hear me. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay, sorry, I was on speaker. So if you go to the research projects, you can see, again, we have the picture of everyone, the lay description, two slides, and then the scientific abstract. And you can click on any of these, and it'll take you directly to that individual's projects. I selected a lot of these slides based on what I had, so if everyone can go through, if you want any changes in those slides or in your pictures or anything else on those, please send those edits to me as well. You can click on the slides and get a larger picture of it so they are more visible, but I need those materials from you. So what I can do is send out the link to this new page, and everybody can take a look. Send me slide sets, any suggestions for edits. And then the other question that I had is whether or not we're ready to share data. So right now we don't have anything on there about what data might be available. I mean, this was a discussion that we had on our last call. So I just need to know when we're ready to make that announcement so that we can identify where exactly we would put that on the website so that people outside of our consortium might be able to make requests of data.
Thanks, Jen. You know, the goal is to make this website a go-to place to learn about FASD and for people to have resources should they need them for their own educational purposes, as well as to provide us with a forum for showing what we're doing in CFAST and for us to be able to integrate our projects and to share our data. So that's our goal, and hopefully this will help us get there by having the news feeds and everything else. And we want to fall right behind or right ahead of Tom Donaldson's group, you know, and the popularity of this site for FSA. All right. So, Johan, are you both ready to go? And is there a preference? Who wants to go first?
No preference.
All right. You're on, Johan.
Is this on a WebEx?
It is.
Can you resend me the WebEx link? Because the one I clicked on didn't work.
Jill, you got that here?
Problem. Doing it right now.
Thanks.
Okay. All right, about 10 or 15 minutes, Johan. All right?
Yeah. Okay, so if everyone can see that, I just wanted to share some exciting news from yesterday that our publication on PDGFRA and their zebrafish model, FASTP, was just accepted for publication in development. So good news there. And then an update for what our shelf screen has been going on. I just kind of run you through the data. We actually submitted these results to ACER maybe almost 3 weeks ago, so we're waiting to hear back on news from that. So I'll just kind of run you through what we did. So if you remember, and can people see my pointer?
Yeah.
Okay. So we ordered mutants that we could obtain live from the Zebrafish International Resource Center. I hyperlinked this if anyone actually wants to see how we did it, but it's really quite straightforward. You can just click on there and search for mutants that are available live, and that's what we did. And then we just got those carriers. We crossed them, put some in ethanol, and then left others as control. And we screened for several phenotypes that we thought were relevant to FASTP, so cell death, the mid-hindbrain boundary that's going to generate the cerebellum of the adult. And we looked at craniofacial skeleton, the size of the eye, and the body length, also the ear that's not on here. At 5 days, we also looked at axon, total axon projections, and neuromass, which are a sensory hair cell on, in the fish.
Johan, this is Jill. I think we're seeing your other screen. Is anyone else thinking that, or am I seeing something different?
Can you go to slide view?
Like slide view.
Yeah.
You're seeing a slide view screen?
So I'm not. You were seeing.
Oh, we're seeing your notes screen.
I can see the screen plus the notes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see the screen plus the note.
Okay. Well, yeah, I don't know how to switch that up. Maybe I'll just talk on this side then. So what we were looking for were defects that weren't present in the untreated mutants or the ethanol-treated wild types, and particularly we're interested in haploinsufficiency, where a reduction in the gene dosage would have some interaction with ethanol. So I hope this isn't too small for you, but so this is the list of all the mutants that we screened. So we started with a larger number of mutants, but there's some attrition along the way, so we were unable to make proper genotyping protocols for some of them. Other lines came to us as homozygous mutants, so we had no internal controls for them. Other lines just died in our nursery. But so we were left with these 20 lines. Five of those interacted with ethanol, and so these are the different screens along the top, and then no is that there was no interaction, and then the Y is that there was an interaction for that phenotype. There was really no sort of sense as if you look for like a gene ontogeny character, whether it's involved in transcription factor or cell proliferation, that these genes don't fall out in any way like that. So we didn't get any great sense for what type of gene might interact with ethanol from this, but we did get five genes that definitely interacted. And so I'm just going to kind of go through those one at a time. So this is just what, so our screen, one thing is that the craniofacial screen always predicted if there was any other effect. So we never found anything in any of these other screens when we didn't pick up anything in a craniofacial. So just what that craniofacial skeleton looks like here, this is a dorsal view of a zebrafish embryo, and to give you some sense of scale from the tip of the snout there to the back of the skull here, that's 700 microns. So all of the screens are done under a microscope. This is the zebrafish's palatal skeleton, and the brain sits right on top of this. If you take a look centrally, just like us, they have a jaw anteriorly, jaw support, and gill arches back here. So we're looking for alterations to that morphology. So just running through the genes, FOXI1 we found it interacted with ethanol. It exacerbated mutant phenotypes. We didn't see any effect on the heterozygotes. But so in the mutants, untreated mutants, you have disruptions to this part of the skull here. And if you take a look then when they're ethanol treated, it's much more severe. So like if you look in this whole mouth, this whole region of the skull is absent in the ethanol treated mutants, whereas it's just here. There were also axon projection defects in these mutants, ethanol treated mutants. So this wild type ethanol treatment, this is what these axon projections into these regions where those cartilages are. So those reiterated cartilages fit right in there. These axons are innervating the muscles for them. And you see that they're pretty apparent, that projections are apparent in the ethanol treated mutant. Two of the genes that we found that interacted with ethanol are actually involved in the cell cycle. There were three genes involved in the cell cycle in total in our screen, so two-thirds of those genes interacted with ethanol. The strongest was with polylike kinase 1 here, where the mutants clearly are hypoplastic in their craniofacial skeleton, but then when they're ethanol-treated, there's just nothing left at all. The eyes are very small. The ears are reduced. The overall body size is smaller. These are very sad, sad fish right here. HNFP, also in the untreated fish, you have reductions to some of these jaw cartilages here, and it's missing all treated mutants. So here again, we're exacerbating phenotypes. We're not seeing anything in the heterozygotes in either of those. The interesting thing with both of these genes is that they interact with cyclins and the cyclin-dependent kinases, which have been postulated as ethanol targets, and PLK1 is also involved in DNA repair.
How are you scoring viability here? Like panel C and F, one might think that those embryos are pretty severely affected and maybe dying, if you will.
So every one of these mutants that we screen is an embryonic lethal. So even the untreated mutants over here will eventually die. So at 4 days when we're doing this screen, these guys are very sick for sure. But when they are still alive, they have hearts, and we can assay that. But it is like, especially with something like the PLK1, you're right. They're very unhealthy at this point. And we think that that's actually because if you take a look very much earlier, they're undergoing massive apoptosis here already at 24 hours. So it's kind of hard. You can't really see the outline of the embryo, but the brain is up here. This is where the eye is. So where the cells that are making the craniofacial skeleton are right in here. So both the brain and these cartilage progenitors are kicking off here already at 24 hours. So definitely these mutants are very sick in ethanol. And if you take a look at the axon, similar to what you see with the craniofacial skeleton, there's virtually nothing left at all. So this is the fifth ganglion here, right back behind the eye, cranial ganglion. That's the only one that's readily apparent in an ethanol-treated PLK1. We found an interaction.
Go on.
Yes.
You have about 5 minutes left. I'm sorry.
Okay. So Mars, this is involved in protein editing, so we found also a slight interaction. It wasn't as dramatic, so a reduction in the skeleton there. Our best interaction that we're most excited about and we're following up on is with Bangle 2, so this is for the cell polarity pathway, which is very important in neural development and in early embryonic development. So untreated Bengal tube mutants have a shortened body axis, which you can't see here, but then you treat them with ethanol, and now their eyes fuse, and this palatal skeleton here gets reduced to a little tiny nub. Their jaw is present. It's just misplaced in the adult. They have some pretty severe defects to their cranial nerves. So this is sort of just what a wild type looks like, and it's very similar to a Bengal mutant. And they're all highly reduced then when you treat them with ethanol. So this is the one we're most excited about. We want to follow up on this because there's evidence implicating the planar cell polarity pathway in ethanol teratogenesis. So that interaction I showed you looked a lot like other members of the planar cell polarity pathway, where the eyes start getting closer together. And actually, Yuva Strahla's lab has shown that early doses of very high doses of ethanol can cause the same eye phenotype that we're seeing now in a much lower dosage of ethanol. And so we're interested in pursuing this with other members of the PCP pathway. So this is the planar cell polarity pathway. It's very large, but these genes with asterisks are known to genetically interact with Bengal 2, so they're very promising candidates. Everything that's underlined, we actually have a mutant available in zebrafish, so nearly the entire pathway is available as mutants. Morpholinos are available in some of the others that aren't. So we'd be really keen on seeing if there's any evidence in humans that any of these interact with ethanol. And we think that this might be a nice tie-in between the genetic predisposition to alcohol and epigenetics, because by combining two different data sets, the PCP pathway is kind of a hotspot for ethanol-sensitive microRNAs, so that was characterized by Spohr et al. And we can combine that by analysis of microRNAs that are involved in cell movements, which the planar cell polarity pathway does. And you can see that there are lots of microRNAs that are all ethanol responsive, all of which except this one are actually upregulated by low doses of ethanol. This is the 1% ethanol, same dosage that we use. And Bengal 2 is actually targeted by a large number of these. So that's kind of where we're going with the results from this screen. If you had any questions that I could answer?
Congratulations on the paper.
Oh, thank you. We're very excited. I'm up for tenure this year, too, so it helped.
It would be great if you could write a little news brief that we could put on the front page of the website.
Yeah, we could do that.
Okay. All righty. Thank you. Any other questions? We have one more minute, and if not, we'll go to...
I have a quick question. There was some discussion over here about the use of zebrafish model for epigenetic effect of alcohol. One question came out, in fish. Can you hear me?
In fish, zebrafish,
you don't have any Y chromosomes, nor you have X. So is it a good model for transgenerational study?
I'm sorry, you're breaking up.
So what I was talking about, the use of zebrafish in prenatal alcohol effect on transgenerational, transgenerational epigenetics. So in fish, you don't have the X chromosomes, nor you have Y chromosomes. So will it be a good model to look at the consequence of this effect on the fetus as well as the, next generation?
Transgenerational effect, is that
right.
What you're at? I think there is imprinting. So I think it is, even without, you're absolutely correct. There's no X or Y chromosome here. So sexual determination is different in fish, but there's definitely imprinting, and several recent publications very nicely characterized early methylation in zebrafish. So I think, it remains to be seen, I guess, but I think it can model that, yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Kathy, can we switch to Kathy's screen?
Pat?
Yep, we're good.
Hey, Johan started with new news. I'm starting with very old news. So the old news is that we've known for a real long time that having alcoholic causes a...
You're breaking up, Kathy.
Okay, I'm going to put myself off of speakerphone. All right. Can you hear me better now?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. So we've known for a long time that alcohol causes defects that are consistent with fetal alcohol syndrome and also holoprosencephaly when administered on day 7. So a natural place to look, in my mind, for gene environment types of interactions, alcohol environment interactions, is to look at the genes that are known to cause holoprosencephaly. So there's an ever-growing list of those genes in human populations, but if you look down the list that I've shown you here, pretty much all of them can be tied to sonic hedgehog signaling. So mutations in hedgehogs cause holoprosencephaly in people, patch, GAS, which is a co-receptor, KIDO, which is the CDON, is a co-receptor. All of these cause holoprosencephaly. So if I were going to make a list of potential candidate genes that would confer exceptional sensitivity to alcohol and the typically recognized face of full-blown fetal alcohol syndrome, this is where I would start. We know that hedgehog is expressed in the early prechordal plate in an embryo. Can you see my pointer? So this is an early day 8 mouse embryo, and the forebrain, which is this part, is just being induced by hedgehog in the ventral midline, and you can see that expression pattern here. That's also becoming really quite old news. Long ago as 2002, Sarah Algren showed us that in a chick model, hedgehog protein could rescue cranial neural crest cell death caused by alcohol. So we've known for a long time that hedgehog is involved. We're learning more and more about hedgehog signaling. We know that the primary cilium is a very important aspect for the transduction of the hedgehog signal. We know that in order for hedgehog to signal, that patch has to de-repress smoothened, so you're always going to hear a lot about patched and smoothened, and then the glees, which are the transcription factors that, in fact, turn on gene expression. We're finding out more and more, as I said, about the receptors for sonic hedgehog on the cell membrane. And among the receptors is something called KIDO, and brother of KIDO, and GAS1, and there's an increasing list of these receptors as well. In October of last year, a lovely paper came out, and I'm showing it to you here, showing that KIDO mutation and prenatal alcohol exposure synergize to cause midline signaling defects and holoprosencephaly. we were both happy and sad to see this paper come out in October because we were working on a similar type of experiment. But the emphasis that they put in the discussion of their paper is what I've shown here in italicized. Our findings argue that ethanol is a risk factor for holoprosencephaly, but genetically predisposed individuals may be particularly susceptible. Furthermore, gene-environment interactions are likely to be important in the multifactorial etiology of holoprosencephaly, but they didn't say in the multifactorial etiology of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, which is really where I think they should have put their emphasis. So at the same time as that paper came out, we were conducting this study. We had hedgehog and GLE2 haploinsufficient mice. and we were mating heterozygous males to homozygous normal C57 black females, which gives you a 1-to-1 ratio of normal animals to heterozygous animals, all within the same litter. And so when you treat the dam with alcohol, you have your controls in the same litter, which is really sort of a nice setup. And so what we have found and what will be presented this year at the RSA and also at the David Smith Conference in August are the data from that study. And what we've been able to show is using a scoring system for craniofacial abnormalities in both genotypes, because in fact the normal animals are being exposed to alcohol too, and we know that alcohol causes defects in them, so we expect there to be some defects in, even in normal animals, but we expect them to be increased in severity as well as in numbers in our abnormal animals. And so in the hedgehog haploinsufficient mice, we had a threefold greater incidence or severity of defects as we scored them. And in the GLE2 animals, it was greater than a sixfold change. So it was expected results, but nice to see when your expectations pan out. So we weren't really surprised that we could cause more holoprosencephaly in those animals. But we also know that when we expose animals a day and a half later to alcohol, we get almost an opposite phenotype, that is too wide of a face. And would one indeed expect an effect by ethanol on the hedgehog pathway to give you too wide of a face? Why would that happen? Would you expect that to happen? There's a paper that came out in 2010 from Jill Helms' group showing that, in fact, that they expect that the holoprosencephalies to the too wide of a face represent a continuum all related to interference with the hedgehog signaling. But they attribute most of the problems with the too wide of a face phenotype to not to brain induction abnormalities, but to effects on the facial mesenchyme, in particular the neural crest cells. However, I think that they didn't start looking at the embryos until day 11. They should have started much earlier, and I think they would have come to a very different type of conclusion. So the next question then for us is, since we showed such nice change involving hedgehog and ethanol with the day 7 exposure, can we also show that interfering with hedgehog via alcohol on day 8.5 gives us also an exacerbated effect? And that experiment is currently in progress. And then at our January conference, we were really excited to see Johan's results showing that LRP2 is a gene that showed up in one of his analyses as giving him more of a phenotype when ethanol exposure occurred. I had a little history with LRP2, and so I knew what it could do, because the person who made the knockout mouse for LRP2 back in 1996 had asked me to do the scanning EM on his embryos. And so what you see is a normal mouse, day 8 mouse forebrain up in the upper left, and you see these big neural folds here. But with the LRP2 knockout on day 8, those animals had a really narrow forebrain. This is what day 7 alcohol-treated animals look like. We now know that LRP2 is also a receptor for hedgehog, just as Kiddo and GAS1 are. It's very important in endocytosing. It attaches to hedgehog and it's co-receptor patched, and is important in endocytosing that whole complex. In addition to being a receptor for hedgehog, it's a receptor for a lot of other things that are really important in development, and that includes the BMPs, and also it is the receptor that brings retinol, which is the precursor to retinoic acid, into the cell. We know that retinoic acid deficiency and retinoic acid excess can cause a lot of problems, including holoprosencephaly. In humans, loss of LRP2 gives you a defect that's known as Denye-Barrow syndrome, and I put an individual with Denye-Barrow syndrome picture here, and you can see that you've got too wide of a distance between the eyes, hypertelorism. There are some corpus callosum abnormalities. There are a lot of ocular abnormalities. And interestingly, also, they get congenital diaphragmatic hernia. I know that congenital diaphragmatic hernia can be caused by the teratogen nitrophen if the exposure is on day 9. So to me, putting everything together, this looks like a day 8 exposure animal. It's got too wide of a face. It's at least a day 8 or a day 9 exposure time because you can also make diaphragmatic hernia. So we managed to get the LRP2 haploinsufficient animals from Dr. Wilnau, who is now in Germany. And our males have arrived. Our females are currently in quarantine, and we hope to repeat the same kind of experiment using these animals. So that's all I had to tell you today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Any questions for Kathy? How common is this Denye-Barrow syndrome?
I don't think it's really very common. It's a rare syndrome. So is Tatiana still on?
No, she had to go to a meeting.
Oh, okay. Because I think, but Johan, are you still here?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, so wasn't Tatiana looking for the LRP2 in the human population?
We're
only looking at a list that Johan gave us and Michael gave us, but I think that's in Peter's hands right now.
Oh, okay.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I have to think about this. I mean, that's pretty interesting stuff. So, all right, I have like 1 minute left, and we have to, I don't know whether Deepak, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm just there.
Want me to throw your slide up on the screen?
Yeah, I can put it in. Which one? Right. You go ahead.
I think I have it. I don't have it anymore. I did before.
Okay, so should I put it in just a quick?
Just quick. I think it's interesting.
Very interesting. Okay, is it going?
You have to give Jill to Deepak.
Jill, is there?
Yeah, I switched to you, and we're seeing your screen. You just need to move it up so we can see it.
Okay, good. So it's basically, you know, you all know I'm looking for this biomarker part 2 gene methylation, and we recently got these salivary samples from Tatiana, and we have about 47 male. A normal male, 29 male, 18 female, and we have about 27 prenatally exposed patients, kids, but no FS, and about 13 FS. So after we got the DNA, we went through all the purification and every methylation and looked at the part gene methylation. And we really saw very beautiful data, which is shown here. As you can see that, the control has about 0.1 methylation ratio, and this ratio went fourfold, 3 to 4-fold in FAS and alcohol exposed animal, both male and female. This is a mean data and is done by non-parametric test, But with the help of Tatiana's group, we did details statistics, and we looked at their distribution of these data are not normal. So when you did the log ratio, they became normal. And with the log ratio, we see that both male and female, there is no difference in respect of exposed animal and FAS. But we get a beautiful 0.0001 differences between control and exposed ethanol exposed and FAS. This is a very small sample in salivary sample, and it's really, really exciting. And I'm very excited and looking forward to getting more samples from Tatiana, as well as with also I'm getting from the San Diego samples. So I think I'm very excited to see how it correlates with the corticosteroid stress axis, and whether or not this methylation pattern lasts for in a longitudinal study, and it could be a potential biomarker. That's all I have to say at the moment.
All right, thank you very much, Deepak. And when I saw the initial graph, great. And thanks, Leah, for doing the SAFTA the correct way, I guess, or a different
right.
way. But so we got a lot going on now in the genetics area, and hopefully we will be collecting more human samples that we can use to look at these effects that have been found with the animal models, and Deepak certainly is going to follow up on his study in the clock gene.
Can I ask a quick question? I know we're running out of time. This
yeah.
is Sarah. So I don't know anything about genetics at all, but could you use that marker to, if you had a kid that where we think there might be alcohol exposure, but we're not sure, could we use that as a marker to tell us whether the child was exposed?
Well, that's what I'm getting at. Actually, I'm also collaborating with Jeff on some of his FS, and also working with Yale and Rajita Sinha. And in Rajita's group, with the adult, the alcohol exposure really increase the methylation tremendously. So the alcohol and part 2 methylation appears to be very, very a strong marker for alcohol exposure and alcohol abuse. So that's what I'm getting at. If this thing longitudinally persists, and if this thing is very specific for alcohol, I think it has a potential biomarker for alcohol exposures.
So we have kids in our sample that I'm fairly confident we have saliva samples on that we ended up excluding because we weren't able to confirm the exposure. If we identify those samples, would that be something worth looking at?
I would be, I really think there's something going on with these clock genes because I've been pushing this. We see beautiful effect in animal cell cultures and all kinds of stuff. And that's why I came to CFAS to see whether or not it really could be used for fetal alcohol. And I'll look into it because I really think there's a potential here.
Okay. Thank you.
All righty. Dale or Bill, any comments?
I've been enjoying the science. It's great.
Yeah.
And thanks, guys, for those nice presentations.
I do appreciate it. Anything from John or Dan?
Nope. John? Same opinion as Bill and Dale.
All righty then. Well, then hopefully I will see most of you at the RSA meeting. Bill and Dale, I sure do hope you get to make it. I can't imagine you sitting in Washington, D.C. while the rest of us are sweating to death in Orlando. Until then, thank you. Any other comments or questions? Okay, then. Take care, and I'll see you at the end of June. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.